From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Black women in the American nursing profession and Caribbean cultures. Those are the topics this week on Soundings, the final segment in a series of discussions devoted to Black History Month, February 1987. My guests are two scholars at the National Humanities Center, Darlene Clark Hine of Purdue University and Franklin Knight of the Johns Hopkins University. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Darlene Clark Hine about her forthcoming study entitled Black Women in White. Following that, a discussion with Franklin Knight about his book, The Caribbean. Here is Darlene Clark Hine.
To my knowledge, there hasn't been a study of black women in the nursing profession by a professionally trained historian. There are a number of books, too, that come to mind immediately that have been written by black women nurses themselves on the history of black women in nursing. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I'm sort of blazing new trail in doing this kind of study.
Do you have a goal as you write a history of black women in the American nursing profession? Is that too simple to say that at the beginning you know what you're going to say?
The goal, of course, is to complete the project. But aside from that, I would like to increase our awareness of the kinds of contributions that black women nurses have made, but also to focus on some of the real problems that have impeded the professional development of black women in American society. And if you take nursing as a microcosmic study, I think you can begin to appreciate the negative impact of racism, the problems that black nurses found in securing adequate educational opportunities, the problems in salary inequities historically, and the struggle to win acceptance, recognition, status within American nursing.
All right, now it sounds like you've just given me a sort of general checklist there of the problems that black women have faced in the American nursing profession. What about, you use the word contributions. What's special or unique there?
Black women entered into organized nursing or professional nursing in the late 1890s, and of course by the mid-20s they numbered 2,000-3,000. One of the major contributions these women made was to help improve the health care delivery available to blacks in rural communities and small towns across the Southeast, the Southwest, and in certain Midwestern cities, not to mention New York, of course. Mm-hmm. Invariably, one found in small southern towns or communities an absence of a black physician or a physician who would treat the people with due respect. So that the nurse, in many instances, became the primary health care giver in countless communities. And she was very respected by the people who sought her out for services.
Was she comfortable doing this in terms of her training and in terms of the way she was viewed professionally, not only by whites, but by black people themselves who were in health care?
Well, that's a very complicated question. You'd have to unravel several strands from it. On the one hand, the black community universally viewed the black woman nurse with a certain amount of respect and admiration and appreciated what she did for them. On the other hand, white nurses were sometimes less charitable in their estimation of black women nurses. And I think part of that derived from economic competition. A certain part of a percentage of their less than charitable attitudes have to deal with the fact that racism is pervasive, and and white women nurses were not immune to racist feelings and simply viewed black women as inferior nurses. Now, some of this was based upon the assumption that most of the schools available, hospital training schools available to black women nurses, were inferior in quality.
Was that true? How, for example, did nursing training compare with what kind of word shall we use it, mainline, white medical training?
There were some great disparities, and black nurse leaders admitted such. In some of the schools, they did not have sufficient clinical material to provide the variety of experience that the black nurse needed, or any nurse for that matter. In the early 20s, sometimes you didn't have adequate instructional facilities. You didn't have enough paid staff people. Many of the hospital nurse training schools were shoestring operations, and so the instruction dimension suffered as the student nurse was expected to devote more of her time to tending to the patients and cleaning the hospital. However, you have to stand back and look at the whole situation and say, well, some the white nursing schools were not all A quality either, so that among the black nursing schools, you had some very, very good ones, outstanding ones, like Lincoln Hospital, Harlem Hospital in New York, Provident Hospital in Chicago, and the Freedman's Hospital in Tuskegee Institute School of Nursing were outstanding. But some of the smaller ones left much to be desired.
Tell me this, Darlene Hine, maybe we should put this question, save it for the last part of our discussion about black women in American nursing. Has the corner been turned? Are you far enough along, what, in your research, in your analysis of this project to talk about something like that?
Well, that gets us into the realm of current events and contemporary social issues. My study ends in 1950.
So it's not fair for me really to ask that.
It's not really fair for you to ask. On the other hand, I can say that having spoken with some black nurses, that they feel that there has been a real turnaround in their profession. After all, only a few years ago, there was a black woman nurse elected president of the American Nurses Association.
Was that a first?
Of course. Mm-hmm. This was a first. And many of the other long-established professional organizations, such as the Medical Association or the Bar Association, have yet to accord black members the kind of equality of representation and participation that the American nurses have.
Mm-hmm. Darlene Hine, you come to the Humanities Center from Purdue University. You're writing a history of black women in American nursing. Anecdotally and briefly, tell me about some of the people that you are writing about. Surely you must be fascinated with them and possibly even had the chance to talk to some of them, I take it.
There is one black woman nurse that I find the most fascinating woman that I have ever had the opportunity to meet.
Who is she?
And her name is Mabel Keaton Stoffers. She was born in 1890, February 27th. She's still alive. She was the woman who almost single-handedly, although she would not put it in those words, she was very generous, led the struggle for the integration of black women nurses into the Army and Navy Nurse Corps during World War II.
Did she see herself that way?
She knew that she was special. She knew that she had a historic role to fill. She was the first executive secretary of the National Association of Colored Graduate Women, Colored Graduate Nurses, a position that she assumed in 1934. Mm-hmm. At that time, black women nurses were excluded from membership in the American Nurses Association and endured all kinds of prejudicial treatment. And Mabel Stoffers came on the scene determined that if it's the last thing she did, she was going to break down the barriers that excluded black women, and she was going to force, if you will, the integration of black women into the American Nurses Association and into the mainstream of nurses.
How would you characterize this transition? Was it a really rocky road? Was it a small and subtle and incremental process? Or are there milestones, as it were, that you look back on as you write this history?
I think on one level it was rocky and stormy and tempestuous.
Mm-hmm.
Naval stoppers had to take on the United States Army, the United States Navy. She enlisted the aid of Eleanor Roosevelt. She organized hundreds of sales of black nurses all over the country. She was active in the NAACP. She worked with A. Philip Randolph. She turned this country upside down and inside out to abolish the segregation and the discrimination, mm-hmm. discriminatory treatment that black women encountered. So she was rocky.
Uh-huh. Darlene, as you write this history of black women in American nursing, I'm asking you a sort of personal question and a sort of methodological question. How do you figure out the difference between the chronology of what you're doing and the way you interpret it? And by extension, is this a crusade? You obviously are very
personal crusade.
You're obviously very enthusiastic about it. How do you want to take this to your audience? In other words,
I really don't have too much difficulty juggling the interpretation with the chronology.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the previous books that have been written have done a straight chronology.
Yeah.
This was achieved at this date and then so on and so forth. And so I use the chronology as sort of a foundation, and I select various themes to form an interpretive analysis, like the crusade for integration.
Right.
It's a central theme in my book. And so I focus on the personalities and the battle plans and the strategies and who was enlisted at what juncture to achieve what purpose. I also focus on the source of funding, the white philanthropic organizations such as the Julius Rosenwald Fund and the General Education Board of the Rockefeller Foundation played a major role in the development of the black nursing profession. And so I developed that theme. It's a theme that has not been given a great deal of attention. Most of the records have only recently been made available to scholars, and I'm perhaps one of the first scholars in the country to take full advantage of this material. And so I can see then how the struggle for integration led by Mabel Stolpers was inextricably linked with the desire of foundation mm-hmm. Officials to facilitate and improve the quality of health care made available to black people in this country. They were the ones who helped finance some of the better nursing training schools and eventually contributed to some of the salaries mm-hmm. that these black nurses activists earned while they were struggling, because they weren't practicing nursing. They were out there struggling, trying to end segregation. And a lot of the resources came from the philanthropist.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sort of themes that I explore that have not been explored in that kind of detail in any other work.
Darlene Hine, let's conclude our conversation about your history of black women in American nursing. What would you tell a general audience? You might wish to correct a misconception, offset a stereotype, present a tiny bit of evidence that you have that you've come across that you think is important. A sort of rephrasing of that first question. So what? why is this important?
If you are at all interested in women's work, if one desires to see beneath the ordinary facade that is presented to one on a day-to-day basis, if one seeks to understand the role that black women have played and the battles that they have fought outside of the home to improve all of American society, If one wants to be more informed than one is, then one will read my book on the history of black women in the nursing profession. And I don't mean to sound arrogant about that. It's just that it's an important story. It's a compelling story. And there's lots to be learned about the nature of American society and the institutions which undergird the society and how black women fit in.
Darlene Clark Hine is a professor at Purdue University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Darlene Clark Hine is at work on a forthcoming study of black women in the American nursing profession. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. The final segment of Soundings for Black History Month continues now with a conversation featuring another scholar at the National Humanities Center. Franklin Knight teaches at the Johns Hopkins University. The topic of our conversation is Franklin Knight's book, The Caribbean, The Genesis of a Fragmented Nationalism, published in 1978 by Oxford University Press. Here is Franklin Knight.
Well, the Caribbean worldview is a part of a third world view, which is to say, societies which are deficient in economic resources and which have political systems presently in a state of tension or trauma, as you might call it. However, I would like to say that the Caribbean states, although they belong to the third world, are in fact unique states. They are the only case in human history of artificially created societies. That is, the intrusive groups had to create an economic system, had to create social conventions entirely without what the English planter in the 18th century, Brian Edwards, called the benefits of experience.
Is there one example that you would point to, Franklin Knight, in your book, The Caribbean, by which a general audience can get, more or less an accurate understanding of all of this heterogeneity, this incredible mixture here?
Oh, yes. You can find it in just about any society, but perhaps the most interesting ones are the ones like Trinidad, Guyana, Jamaica, Barbados.
Why would you pick those?
I pick those because they have discrete elements uh-huh. of foreign cultures. You get a Europeanized segment. Let's take as a concrete example Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And you can see how the fragmentation affects the national norms today. Today, Trinidad is a society with 55% East Indians. The first East Indian immigrants came there only a little over 150 years ago. Hmm. It has a minority of Europeans, but in as late as 1812, there were only 2,500 Europeans divided into 48 European nationalities. Mm-hmm. So these 48 nationalities could not present, in a population of about 15,000, a cohesive national culture, as the European states were moving to national cultures in the 19th century. But what you do find, which is curious in both, in any Caribbean state, which is, I think, more discernible than it is in the United States, is the way that things really amalgamate there. Let's take a concrete example of Jamaica. Jamaica has no more than 5% Europeans in the present population, but the structure and the language is European derived. Mm-hmm. So they give the basic social norms to the society that everyone conforms to. Yet the Europeans you'll find in Jamaica speak an English which is quite indistinct from the black Jamaicans, the Chinese Jamaicans, the East Indian Jamaicans.
And never the twain shall meet, I take it.
Well, oh yes, they do meet.
They do?
They do meet, and they meet on equal grounds. Uh-huh. It would be inconceivable anywhere in the Caribbean for any scholar to come up with a theory of racial superiority or inferiority, for example, unless it were turned upside down to the way the United States uses it. That is, whether small minorities are considered inferior. And in some cases where the practical example substantiates this, for example, the small groups of Irish in Barbados who are called walking backers, or the descendants of the German settlers of the 19th century in Jamaica, in southwestern Jamaica, you will find that the cause of this apparent intellectual inferiority is inbreeding over generations. Mm-hmm. So it's a closed, endogamous society which produces this.
Let's use that Franklin Knight as a jumping off point for yet another question about your book, The Caribbean. Why is it, you just used the word intellectual, you make your living as a historian, why is it important that we understand the Caribbean as it were from the inside out? You discuss in your book the notion of a Caribbean rather than a European perspective. Tell me about that.
Well, I think that's a very important point, because a European or non-Caribbean perspective cannot offer a proper window on Caribbean society. If you see the Caribbean as merely an appendage to the United States or an appendage to Europe, you cannot properly understand the motive forces. And let me give you two examples from history, since I did write a history book about it. One, of course, is the calamity of the French Revolution as it played itself out in the French Caribbean colony of Saint-Domingue in 1789. Mm-hmm. Now, this catastrophe occurred because Frenchmen kept thinking that the French in Saint-Domingue were equal to the French in France, which is to say they were talking about socialist states in a uniform ethnic structure. However, when you moved from France, mainland France, to the French colony, there is no such thing as a nobility of blood. There are no socialist states derived by tradition as they are in France. What you have are communities based on skin color and occupation relationship to sugar production. So free coloreds who spoke French and owned estates considered themselves equal to whites who owned estates and spoke French as well as they did, and superior to poor whites who did not own estates and in fact were in the managerial positions. On the other hand, the free whites, poor whites, thought that because they were of French descent and the free coloreds were not, then they were better Frenchmen or ought to be declared citizens, mm-hmm. rather than the free coloreds.
Translate that for me very quickly into the doing of history. How does that sort of a concrete example affect our understanding of Caribbean history? Are we talking about stereotypes?
Yes, we are talking, but we're talking about more than just stereotypes. We're talking about distortions.
Yeah.
And the distortion comes up in, say, the second example. One of which you alluded to, that we think the Caribbean is a backward society. In fact, there is no more creative and constructive society anywhere else. If you look in music and literature, mm-hmm. True, there aren't the scientific breakthroughs that you find, but certainly in medicine and practical things they are. The Caribbean people have always been creative, and they're forced to be, mm-hmm. because they live in a very difficult environment. And if you look proportionately, they produce probably far more distinguished people in literature than any of the mainland societies round about.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, if you talk about the economy, we're all talking about the economy and what is poverty, which is a relative and subjective term. It is very common, if you look at the Caribbean through gross national product statistics of the United States or any of the European states, that these are very poor society. But when you go down to live in the Caribbean, it then becomes an entirely different picture. If you go to Puerto Rico, I'm astonished that the statistics tell me that 65% of Puerto Ricans are in some form of federal Social Security support.
Goodness.
And yet, there are no old cars in Puerto Rico. There are no hungry people in Puerto Rico. Uh-huh. They all live in fine houses, most of them. There is an element of poor, but certainly the visual impression you get belies all the statistics.
So we're talking about defining terms here.
Yes,
as much as
we're talking about defining terms, and we're talking about a social system which is not understood, because a lot of Puerto Ricans, as a lot of Caribbean people, do not live in an active cash economy, or should I say, do not depend entirely upon cash earnings for their living.
Uh-huh.
And so, again, if you talk about the Caribbean as enduring as the English thought when they considered the Caribbean a part, an integral part of the British Empire, undergoing rack and ruin because the sugar industry was declining, they failed to realize that at the very time in the 19th century that the sugar economy was declining, there was a very enormous expansion and creativity among peasants who were producing rice and bananas and coffee and small crops, and the internal economy, in fact, continued to expand enormously for some 30 years after the sugar industry reached its nadir.
Mm-hmm.
When the local economy started collapsing, happened because of internal factors, only some of which are related to the sugar industry. So there again, if you look at it internally, you're not misled by the gross national statistics, mm-hmm. which tell you what the primary product or primary export is doing.
Franklin Knight, let's conclude our conversation. We're discussing your book, The Caribbean. At one point, you call the Caribbean fragmented. You say that the area is like a broken vase, but nevertheless providing clues to form and beauty, the value of the past. By way of that reflection, what would you tell a general audience about the Caribbean? What is it important that we know that, in your opinion, people don't know or don't appreciate about this region of the world?
Well, for one thing, of course, is that the Caribbean people are far more familiar with diversity. They're far more tolerant of new forms, of new ideas. They have always been far more eclectic than normal Europeans and North Americans are wont to be. And so, for example, from the North American point of view, we are a little worried, for example, that Cuba is socialist, 90 miles from the United States, or we raised an enormous rucus over Grenada that it was going communist, a state with less than 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. And then we distorted our foreign policy initiatives in that direction because we exaggerated the impact that a socialist Grenada would have on its neighbors. But as the late Prime Minister of Barbados, John Adams, pointed out, Tom Adams, I beg your pardon, pointed out that Barbados had nothing to fear from Grenada, because if Grenada wanted to get an example, it was more common to get it from Barbados than the other way around. And the same thing is true when North Americans were astonished at the reception given to this religious cult from California in Guyana. But in fact, throughout the Caribbean, they have always been generous and receptive to all sorts of what might, from the outside, seem crazy cults.
Well, it complements this idea of heterogeneity.
Yes, that people can live together in a plural way, in an integrated pluralism, mm-hmm. rather than this parallel pluralism, which looks at little ethnic communities the way that New York is brought together with its little divisions and its zones, which are really tightly knit ethnicities.
Neighborhoods.
Neighborhoods is one way of describing it, but they are really not neighborly. Mm-hmm. So it's the neighborhoods without the neighborliness.
Franklin Knight teaches at the Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of The Caribbean, published by Oxford University Press in 1978. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Franklin Knight is at work on a forthcoming study about Spanish-American Creole society in Cuba in the 18th and 19th centuries. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of this edition of Soundings for Black History Month, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about art, society, and political patronage in Renaissance Italy. My guest will be Dale Kent of La Trobe University in Australia. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for two conversations on topics related to Black History Month, February 1987. Darlene Clark Hine of Purdue University discusses her forthcoming study of Black women in the American nursing profession, and Franklin Knight of the Johns Hopkins University discusses his study of cultural fragmentation in the Caribbean. Black Women in White and the Caribbean, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.